Okay. Phlegm is under control.
You should do that to start the show. That should be like your intro. Yeah, so. Mary Tyler Moore has her meowing kitten. We have our gargling van.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. This week we present our inaugural, that means first annual, Year in Film Edition, the movies of 2012. And joining me to talk about the ones that had an impact on us, either in a good way or a bad way, is Bobby Polite.
Howdy.
Hi, yes, Bobby. Those who have listened to Episode 3, the first installment in our Superheroes and Novels and Beyond series, and quite a few have because it's one of our most popular episodes so far, will recall that Bobby is an old friend of mine and my co-plotter on the Sentinels books, about more in just a second. So welcome back aboard, Bobby. You are the first returning guest, so I am dubbing you our returning champion.
Ah, I feel honored.
And you should. Okay. Our other guests have been great, too, by the way. But I'm really happy to have Bobby back to talk about movies for 2012. Now, before we get into that, we have some news, some White Rocket news this week. The new Sentinels novel from White Rocket Books, Volume 7 in the series, is now on sale. It's called Sentinels Metal God. And in addition to the usual antics of our beloved super team, there are more chapters of the latest of what's happening with what is probably Bobby's single biggest contribution, though he's made a lot, to that universe, Star Knight. So if you want to find out what's going on with Pulsar and Ezra Brakis and Mondrian and Vanadium and all that kind of good stuff, Ultra, I guess, kind of, that's a spoiler, can't really talk about that. But especially if you want to see what's going on with young Mitch Michelson and his golden alter ego, then pick up a copy. The book is now out in trade paperback. And as of today, about 10 minutes ago, it is now on Kindle. So you can read it in your hands or you can read it on your little Kindle. So just go to whiterocketbooks.com, whiterocketbooks.com, and you'll see it at the top. Or just go to Amazon and search Sentinels Metal God or Plexico Sentinels, whatever, and you'll find it. And I'm pretty excited about that. So I just want as many people to know about it as possible. Okay, so with that business out of the way, Bobby, let us dig into the movies of 2012. What do you say?
Okay.
All right, let's see. Now, the way we've decided to sort of do this is, see, I've seen some movies, Bobby's seen some movies, some of them overlap, some of them don't. So when it's a movie that we're going to kind of go in chronological order of release, we're going to start back in like January of 2012 and work our way up to this past weekend. You can kind of guess what one of the last ones we'll talk about is. So if it's a movie only I've seen, I'll talk a little bit about it. If it's one only Bobby has seen, he can talk about it. And if it's one we've both seen, we'll dig into it a little bit and discuss if it merits that. The first movie up is The Gray, the Liam Neeson film, and I believe I'm the only one that saw that. You know, I liked that movie a good bit. I thought it was very stylish. It had some cool flashbacks and cross-cutting, great cinematography up in the frozen north. The quick breakdown is Liam Neeson is a guy who has a high-powered rifle and protects, you know, the Alaska pipeline guys from wolves. And he ends up, you know, stranded out in the wilderness trying to protect some people who are trying to make their way back to their camp. And they're beset all the way by wolves. So it's a really cool survival story with Neeson in sort of that role. I think he does the best of the sort of rugged, in charge guy who can sort of lead a group of people that otherwise would be dead 10 minutes into the movie. So
it was taken by wolves.
Yeah, exactly. Taken by, there you go. Yeah. So he does that pretty well. Somebody said, why on earth would you kidnap anybody in Liam Neeson's family? he trained Darth Vader and he punches wolves.
Yeah, the ads for that movie just didn't really resonate with me at all. I remember it coming out. I like Liam Neeson a lot, but it just, I don't know. All I got out of it was run through the woods being chased by wolves, and that, you know, that's a wait for video for me.
It is, yeah. Anything. Yeah, I would definitely watch it on video. In fact, I think that's how I saw it, is it came out a couple of months ago on video and I saw it. But yeah, there's a lot of really intense character stuff going on in there too that makes it a little bit better than just an action movie. So the next movie, and one of the big ones I think we really want to talk about, and I haven't discussed this movie, I don't think, much at all with you, though I suspect I know how you sort of feel about it, is John Carter.
So, what do you most think? Unjustly maligned movie of the year.
Yeah, okay. I would tend to agree. You know, it says a lot when there's actually a book out about how they messed up, you know, marketing a good movie. There's actually a book called, was it John Carter and the Monsters of Hollywood or something like that?
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, it just came out a few days ago. You can see it. If you Google Coming Attractions Pulp, it's in there with Metal God, actually, but it's on there as one of the books that just came out. It basically gives you the whole story of how Hollywood took it and messed up the marketing and the identity of it.
Well, there's something wrong if 2 weeks into the release, the company that put the movie out is already talking about how they're going to lose $200 million on this movie instead of trying to play it up and try to get people to go see it.
Yeah.
It's almost like Disney embraced the Schadenfreude?
Yeah.
The misery and went, look, you know, we love that this movie's failing. And I just don't even understand that.
No.
I was shocked because when the reviews started coming out, I was really worried. I was worried about the movie before it even came out because, you know, it's John Carter. Mm-hmm. How can you do that?
Yeah.
There's so much there to it, and I just didn't know what to expect. And then I went and saw it, and I loved it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I thought it was great.
Yeah, I think that we ought to talk about that for a second. Is we did both love it, right?
Oh, yeah.
And there's so much about it to love. I mean, the way I see it is it gets everything right from the book, or the books, really, that could be gotten right in a 2012 movie. And in the 100th anniversary, by the way, of the first book. And it changes the things that you just had to change, mostly in a good way, I think.
Yeah, they don't deal with like the atmosphere plant and mm-hmm. that sort of thing, which would have been kind of old and dry, and it would have been anticlimactic. You know, there's not a lot of action there, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And they bookended it. I think the only thing that I would complain about in the movie is I don't remember John Carter being that dour.
Yeah.
They changed him into a figure that was trying to overcome some past tragedy, which was not part of the John Carter books at all.
No, right. No, he's a heroic soldier. I mean, he's had some bad turns after the war or whatever, but yeah, he's one of that classic breed from the early 20th century of the stoic Superman hero that you know, that doesn't have feet of clay. He's more of a man of steel. You know, I know that Superman kind of is made off with all this sort of thing, but Doc Savage was that way. John Carter was that way. You know, there were a number of Conan to a certain degree was that way. They were just these guys that never really questioned themselves. They had utter confidence. They were great leaders, leaders of men. The women all wanted them. The men all wanted to follow them, you know, and cheer them and fight for them. And that's just a great, you know, it's the kind of thing that Hollywood would make 50 years ago or more, or 60, 70 years ago, really now. And it's kind of a shame that when they make it in 2012, they feel the need to give him all these flaws, to make him, like you say, dour and having to overcome. And, you know, there was another character that they did that to in a movie recently. And I'm
Superman. That's upcoming. Never mind.
And they kind of played that up in The Hobbit, which we're going to talk about a little bit later on, too. They sort of played up that idea of the doubts. Because, you know, what it is, we've talked about before about how Hollywood loves the story where a character starts out one way and learns some lesson and grows as a character and is better and more tougher. And, you know, I mean, at the end, you know, Spider-Man's origin story has that, and the Frodo in the first Lord of the Rings movie had that, where he kept trying to give the ring away the whole movie, and at the end he finally closes his hand on the ring and says, you know, I'm going to do this myself. You know, Hollywood loves that. It's why every superhero movie is the origin over again, because that's the story Hollywood knows how to tell. And so John Carter was kind of that same way. They turned him into a modern superhero in some ways, but it wasn't. But I don't think that undercut the movie seriously in any way.
No, I think the movie's got, you know, it's a movie that you really couldn't have made 20 years ago without, you know, dressing up a bunch of people in green makeup with fake, you know, extra fake limbs and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. The Tharks looked amazing.
Yeah.
And you needed the modern technology to do that. What's unfortunate, though, is, and I can see this from the point of view of audiences who don't have a lot of experience with the history of these pulp characters. They come into it and go, I've seen all these situations in other movies, and I just want to scream, but it was here first.
Yeah.
All these other movies come off of this. Yeah. I mean, Jedi comes from Jeddak. I mean, it's just all of this stuff traces back to these John Carter novels, all this planetary romance. And I just love seeing it on the screen. I'm sad there's probably not going to be another one.
Yeah.
But I'm very glad I got that one.
Yeah, you know, it's almost too bad that a poor John Carter movie 50, 60 years ago never was made. I mean, Disney talked about doing it. There were others that it's one of those things that's been almost made for almost 100 years, if not 100 years. And if only somebody had actually succeeded in making it, even if it was bad, you know, decades ago, then this would have been like, oh, a remake of the classic. But instead, since they never actually made it, nobody knew what it was. And then, of course, then they took Of Mars out of the title. They didn't put Warlord in there. Anything that would give you a sense other than just Joe Smith, right?
And you know, my understanding is that that was taken out because it wasn't playing well because of the Mars Needs Women failures.
Oh, whatever.
And, you know, A Princess of Mars didn't play well because, you know, what 14-year-old boy is going to go see a movie that's about a princess?
Yeah.
And so they just truncated it to John Carter, and that could have been about, you know, a guy making jeans in his backyard,
sure,
for all you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's unfortunate they did that with the title.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should have kept going with what they had. It was just a bad marketing plan all around. They did nothing to play up anything but the most trite parts of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it just seem like generic adventure number three.
We would be remiss if we don't mention the revelation of Deja Thoris. I thought that the actress that they got to play her was glorious.
Lynn Collins was phenomenal.
Yes.
She is the Deja Thoris of our dreams.
Yeah. She could have kicked John Carter's butt in that movie,
I think. I loved how they updated her character.
Yeah.
She's not just running off, you know, getting into trouble, and they made her a scientist, and they just the update of her character was great.
Yeah, she wasn't just really beautiful and everybody was either trying to protect her or get her. You know, instead, she actually had a role beyond that. Now, I mean, everybody loves Deja Thoris that knows the John Carter of Mars story. You know, they all love her as the great Martian princess. And she has a lot to go for, you know, just from that. But to make her on top of all that a really interesting, more three-dimensional character. And the actress that played her, again, Lynn Collins, being just gorgeous and tough looking. I mean, she looked tough. She looked like she could beat you down.
I was reading some articles about her. She apparently actually knows how to use a sword. She's in shape, and she knew what she was doing with that thing. So, and it just showed. It showed when she was holding it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, great, great movie, and you know, it's sad that two of my favorite science fiction movies that have come out in the last few years, we're never going to get a sequel to, even though the people that saw them love them, and that's John Carter and Serenity.
Yeah.
Two awesome action sci-fi movies that deserve to be huge hits, and neither one of them apparently. I mean, John Carter's probably going to make its money back, don't you think, if it hadn't already?
It's probably going to come close, but it's still going to be considered a failure because it made like $76 million or something like that at the theater. And that's, you know, given its reported budget, that's not very good.
But globally it did better.
It did better, but I don't think it even reached its budget. I haven't checked the numbers,
yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, Serenity, though, Serenity was just a gift to the fans. I never expected anything more out of that.
I know, but see, the thing was that with Serenity, I really thought that people would see it and go, whoa, this is awesome. I don't have any idea what this is or who these characters are, but this is an awesome movie. And, so, and it just fizzled out, you know. So
I bet right now if Joss Whedon went up to somebody and said, I'm making a sequel to Serenity, they'd go, okay.
He could make his laundry list and people would be like, sure, whatever you want to do, man. You're the man. Well, we'll get to that one in a minute, too. Let's see. I got a few here in a row that I've seen that you have not, and I'll just kind of run through them. If you want to add anything, your impressions or anything on them, that would be great. Otherwise, I'll just kind of zip through them quickly. I saw The Hunger Games because my wife and my older daughter both are fans of those books to a certain degree. And I went in with a lot of trepidation about what it was, the subject matter, little kids killing each other as part of a government policy. And it was pretty much that. And the one thing that really I thought it was more or less well done. It kept my attention. It was entertaining when I didn't stop to think what it was really being about, you know. And what really bothered me about it was, and I guess this is probably something that they were at least somewhat trying to do, is occasionally I would find myself almost rooting or watching it like it was a sporting contest and wanting a scoreboard to see how it was going. And when
the Running Man.
Yeah. And as soon as I would realize what it was I was wanting to see on that hypothetical scoreboard, I would be horrified at myself and ashamed of myself and quit thinking that until the movie pulled me back in again. And then I would think, well, gosh, I wonder how many of them are left and who's, oh man, stop thinking that, you know? So it was very affecting for what it was trying to do. It's not something I really, you know, it's not something I would have gone to see by myself, and it's not something I really enjoy that much, but I was impressed with how it affected me in a powerful way. It is a powerful story. I'll give it that.
I think that's why I haven't seen it. It wasn't a movie that drew me in. I wouldn't go to see it by myself, and nobody else that I knew really had any drive to see it. Mm-hmm. But I've got the Blu-ray sitting in the other room. I just haven't taken the time to watch it yet.
Yeah, well, it's pretty well done. I mean, it's not... there's nothing super innovative or anything about it, but it certainly will pull you in and you'll care about the characters to a certain degree, I think, anyway. I got Wrath of the Titans on video. I made it about 10 minutes in and I lost all interest. I guess I'll eventually go back and watch it. It's just, you know, these big brainless, we've got CGI, let's make gods and monsters and sea serpents and everything.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I saw Clash of the Titans. I couldn't do it. I don't know what it is. I can't watch a movie retelling myths that just starts jumbling in all kinds of other stuff.
Yeah.
It just drives me nuts. I'm a little too anal about my mythology, I guess. But I absolutely hated Clash of the Titans. There was no way you were going to get me in the seat for this one.
Well, you know, let's be honest. What you just said is certainly true, but that aside, you know, honestly, these movies aren't that much different from the old Harryhausen stop motion monster movies like that. I mean, if we'd had this back in 1975, we'd thought it was the greatest thing ever, you know, so to a certain degree.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not really that well taken with the original Clash of the Titans.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got some neat stuff, but, you know, they mix Shakespeare into Greek myth with Caliban, and I just, I don't know. I just didn't really enjoy it that much.
Yeah, so. I just was not in the right mindset for it, so I haven't gotten all the way through it, but I did try to watch it and just The Cabin in the Woods. I got to talk about this one because just about 80% of my various online friends around the world saw this and were just raving about how great it was. This is the Joss Whedon movie that sat on a shelf for like a year or two, right? And it's sort of his take at a horror movie, but with a few twists along the way. And I know that my good friend Gary Mitchell, who does the Revolution SF Revcast with me and with Deanna, Gary loved it. He kind of almost talked me into seeing it with his review. My wife hated it. She was ready to leave the theater halfway through. I thought it was cute. It had some nice moments. It had some Joss Whedon moments. And of course, the last probably 20 minutes of it, I won't give anything away really. If you haven't seen it, this is a movie you really need to see, not really knowing much at all about it. If you're gonna take the time to watch it, you need to know very little about it. But the last 20 minutes sort of turns everything on its head and has some surprises. So Yeah, if you like Joss Whedon's humor, if you like how he does sort of teenage characters, you know, kind of Buffy-type characters and monsters and stuff, then you'll probably, you definitely want to see it on video. Did you have any interest in that one? Or
I do have an interest in it. I just haven't taken the time to watch it.
Yeah.
So
it would be a good movie to watch with a bunch of friends, have some popcorn, sit around the house, you know, watch it late at night and just laugh, you know, and cut up. That would probably be my recommendation.
At the risk of sounding like a Whedon fanboy, that's probably the only reason I have any interest in it, because the horror genre really doesn't do much for me. And I know it's not quite that, but it is that to some degree, right?
Well, yeah, it starts out as the typical setup for a horror movie of this type, but because he wrote it and was so involved, it takes some distinct twists. So yeah, I agree. If it was just teenagers going to a cabin in the woods and somebody in a ski mask killing them, I would have less than no interest in it at all. So
yeah.
So yeah, the fact that I recommend it at all shows you there's more to it than that. Okay. I saw The Raven, which is the Edgar Allan Poe movie with what's his name from High Fidelity? Why am I blanking? You know
John Cusack.
Yeah, John Cusack. He was pretty good. I mean, he was John Cusack in a goatee. Look at it was like it was like if John Cusack dressed up like Tony Stark. But you know, it was somebody is murdering people in Baltimore using the various methods from his stories. And so immediately people think he's doing it. And then once he kind of clears himself, he kind of becomes Sherlock Holmes, almost trying to figure out who's doing it. And before the next person gets killed and it affects somebody close to him and this, that, and the other. But, basically, it fits the whole thing into about the last week of his life. So, it's all right. It had its moments. It's worth a video look.
Yeah, that's probably how I'll watch it. I usually eventually get around to watching just about any movie with John Cusack in it, and yeah. I'll wait for video on that one.
Yeah. Safe. This is the last of the ones only I saw before we get to the next big one. This is another brainless Jason Statham movie. I love Jason Statham. I'm going to try to forgive him for Parker when I see it in a few weeks because I dearly love Jason Statham and I dearly love Parker, but the two have no business being in the same movie, much less as that character. But in this one, it's funny because he's started doing these movies now where he plays usually like an American policeman. And for a while, they would try to explain in the story why this American policeman sounds like he's from, you know, South London or something. And they've basically just given up now because, A, he's never going to sound American. He doesn't have that. You know, there's all kinds of British and Australian actors that are over here now doing American accents, like Apollo in Battlestar Galactica and Dr. House and the guy in Homeland. They're all British or Australian. And they sound American. Statham cannot sound American. And they've just basically just given up on explaining it now. And he's just this American who happens to sound Cockney. And, you know, they're like, just deal with it. Just go with it. Don't worry about it. And I kind of like that. It's probably a good thing. It saves 5 minutes of them trying to explain it, you know. So it's just another one of those. I mean, you know, if you want to see Jason Statham beat some people up and shoot some people, and once again, there's a young Asian girl that he's trying, all this time she's about 10. But there's, you know, half of his movies, it seems like there's a young Asian girl he's trying to rescue from some bad guys. So it's just more formulaic Statham insanity. But I enjoy that. So, you know.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing.
No. Okay, now we get to the summer and probably the single biggest movie of the year, although we'll see what happens with The Hobbit. But probably the single biggest movie of the year.
The Dictator?
That's next. A certain little movie about a certain little superhero team that you and I have loved our whole lives, pretty much. The Avengers.
I have never been so nervous going into a movie in my life. Iron Man was close. But I went and saw it. My boss at work gave our whole team that Friday morning off.
Oh, man.
And we went and saw the first showing.
Wow.
And we got in there, and that theater was packed on a Friday morning when school is still in, and it's packed.
There's your clue.
And as we were coming out, the theater was packed. And that's when I looked around and went, oh, my goodness, this movie is going to hit $200 million. And sure enough, it did. And it deserves it. Oh, it is like the perfect action movie.
You mean like first week, right, or first weekend?
First weekend, yes.
First weekend, yeah. I was going to say, because yes, it ended up at like $1.5 billion.
Oh, yeah. No, but yes. I through the whole movie, I was just completely and totally excited. I had to go see it again that evening because I was so hyped up that I knew I missed stuff. At the end of the movie, I took all of my willpower to resist sending you a text about the end scene.
Well, let me tell you,
and for the first time ever, I've liked the Hulk.
I know.
I've never liked the Hulk in comic books or anything. Right. In this movie, he was fantastic.
Because they knew how to use him. Exactly. I still don't know if I'd want to see a solo Hulk movie. But
you know, with Mark Ruffalo, I think I would. I like him as an actor. So I would probably give a solo Hulk movie a try at this point.
Yeah, more than I would have before, I agree. I just think that he's one of those characters like Doctor Strange, like Nick Fury, like the Submariner. There's a certain set of Marvel characters that really work better playing off of A-list characters. They work better playing off of the main character. I like to see Hulk interacting with Thor, interacting with Tony Stark. I don't want to see Hulk interacting with, you know, Liv Tyler or something. That just bores me. Yeah, what you were saying about the end scene. David Wright, who was our guest on episode 2 talking about the Dark Tower, David Wright actually saw it before me, and he had sent a message to my wife secretly saying, video, you know, watch Van or film Van in the first post credits bit. And so, and I mentioned this, I think, before on here, that I'm sitting there and all of a sudden I realize she's pointing the camera at me. I'm like, what are you doing? And she says, just watch the movie. I'm like, okay. And then of course, when you know who we can say at this point, my God, when Thanos comes out, you know, there at the end and is revealed, right? My jaw hit the floor. And so that's on a video somewhere. I need to get that up on YouTube.
You know, the thing is, I kind of figured he was going to be at the end of the movie because there's that scene where Loki is sitting there and he's all nervous and he gets transported to talk to the leader of the Chitauri.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes out of it, he's like almost shaking. And I'm like, who in the world would make Loki nervous out in space? Oh, okay. Oh, I know where that's going.
you know, and it's funny too, because
Cosmic Cube, Thanos. Right. Okay.
Yep. That's exactly. Yeah. You know, I did not ever dream, cause I love the cosmic, right? I love the whole cosmic angle of Marvel. And I really expected them to keep it more down to earth. I was expecting the Masters of Evil or coming up next or Ultron, you know, or something that was more down to earth. And so, but the story I'm told is that Joss Whedon, when he was writing the script, he gets to the end and he says, well, I need somebody that's the manipulator. And he didn't know who it was going to be yet. And he went to Marvel and he said, who can I use? And they said, who do you want? And he says, I figured they'd never let me use Thanos, but I might as well throw it out there and get turned down. So I said, how about Thanos? And they go, okay. And he said, I almost fell over. I'm like, oh, he said, I ran off and did it before they could change their mind, you know? So, Jim Yelton and I on the Marvel movies episodes the last couple of weeks have been talking about this fact that now that they have Thanos in there, it's going to get even more cosmic. You got the Guardians of the Galaxy coming up. So
the wrong Guardians of the Galaxy.
Well, I know. Well, we could debate that. I like them both. But this is really taking it in a much more of a cosmic outer space kind of a direction than I ever dreamed they would be wanting to go with the franchises, plural. So
yeah.
What do you think about that? Is this the right direction? And how are they going to pull this off?
Wow, they're going to have to do a lot to top that first movie, no matter what they do. And I don't know. I don't know how they're going to pull it off. There's the big chance that you're going to throw this big giant villain in there, and it's going to be a big letdown.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it. I haven't wanted to think about it. I want to see the next few movies first and try to get a feel for where they're going, because I personally am kind of trepidatious about the next few movies. I don't really like, for instance, the Winter Soldier. So the Cap movie's making me nervous.
Hmm.
I'm curious as to where they're going to go with, you know, Ben Kingsley playing the Mandarin. The trailer that they released for Iron Man 3 looks good.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful there. And I have no idea what's going on in Thor other than apparently they're going to fight the Dark Elves.
Yeah.
You know, I have heard rumor that Doctor Strange may appear in Thor.
Oh, I hadn't
that would be amazing.
Well, that would be a good place to put him. He's not going to turn up in Captain America. You'd have to have a very specific story for Captain America to need to meet him. It makes more sense to put the magical kind of stuff over in the Thor corner of the universe, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah. No, it does.
Yeah. Well, a couple more things about the movie before we move on, because this is our first chance that you and I have really had to talk about it for the audience. What did you think about the various story choices that Whedon made? I mean, was there anything that you thought was a mistake or that you would have done pretty seriously different, or is it just a perfect movie? What do you think?
Wow, I almost want to try to find something to criticize.
I know.
And I can't, because, I mean, you've got a bunch of characters that you're throwing in, and the odds from the beginning are it's going to be, you know, Iron Man, Captain America, and Thor, and, oh, by the way, there's these other guys in the background. And that wasn't the case. I mean, the Black Widow is the character that coming out of it. I'm like, I want to see more of her.
Mm-hmm.
I loved her intro scene. I think it did a great job of setting who she was. I love the look of fear in her eyes when Bruce Banner smacks the table in front of her while they're having the conversation in India.
Yeah.
He did a really good job of giving all the characters their roles. And like, there's one scene in the movie that is I think of it as the George Perez scene. It starts when Cap flips the Black Widow up with his shield onto the back of
I know exactly what that, you're talking about.
Of that scooter, the flying scooter thing. And from there, it's one continuous shot where characters bleed into the scene and out of the scene as they work together to move around. That scene was phenomenal.
That's
and then
amazing.
He capped it off with a joke.
That was amazing. Yeah.
And it was perfect.
Oh, it was amazing. Yeah.
But no, I think the bar has been set exceedingly high for the second movie. I hope he can eclipse it.
Yeah.
But
if he could just come close to it, it'd probably be good enough. But yeah, we hope.
Yeah, yes.
The one thing I was disappointed about really was that we only had the one female character, the Black Widow. I mean, we knew that going in. We knew they were setting her up and everything. Instead of the Wasp. Now, you know, it does look like we're going to get the Wasp, or at least Jan, in Iron Man 3. And she looks perfect.
Really? She's not going to be in the Ant-Man movie?
Well, that's not for years yet. That movie's not till like 2016 or something.
That's true. I didn't think they would introduce her until then.
Yeah, no, there's a character that we've seen pictures of. One picture, she's driving a car, and one, she's like kissing Tony. And I mean, if it's not Jan, then they've taken an actress and wasted her on a different part, because the hairstyle, the little perky nose and everything, she looks just like Jan.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of that in terms of criticizing the Avengers. I wish they had had Ant-Man and the Wasp in the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that they weren't going to have it, you know, have her in there, I didn't even think anything about that. I would love to see that character introduced. And I think they probably really ought to know that they should introduce that character, because she's like the best thing on the cartoon.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. She is cool. And the other thing, I guess, is Hawkeye. I mean, I've said before that Hawkeye basically has no personality, because they gave his personality to Tony Stark in the movie universe.
That is true.
And so he's just kind of bland. And I almost wish we could have gotten like a secret agent-y Black Widow Hawkeye movie before Avengers, just so we would know him a little bit better, because I think he's the least developed of any of the characters. In fact, he spends half the movie being, you know, mentally controlled by Loki, so that you don't even get Hawkeye when you have Hawkeye.
That's true.
So I was disappointed with Hawkeye, but hopefully they'll...
But that does touch on his roots as an unintentional bad guy, too.
Yeah, that was kind of neat that they did that. Yeah, I agree. All right, any other Avengers tidbits before we move on?
Wow, no, I could probably talk about it for a long time.
I know. It was awesome. Yeah, I've got it on Blu-ray. I haven't watched it yet. My daughter thinks I'm crazy. She thinks we should have already watched it 10 times. I'm like, I saw it, you know, 3 times in the theater, which for me is a lot.
I saw it 5.
Yeah. Well, now see, it takes my all-time favorite movie is Fellowship of the Ring, and I saw it 8 times in the theater, and that's by far the most of anything I've ever seen. I saw Return of the King 4 times, which is second. So I generally don't see things in the theater more than once, very rarely. So 8 is astonishing, and the Avengers 3 times at that running length was a lot for how much money it cost and everything, and time to get away with the kids and all that. So I did get to see it with some fellow fan people in Birmingham. That was really fun. So you guys that got to go with me and my sister to see it in Birmingham during Alabama Phoenix Festival back in May or June, that was awesome. That was a good time. All right. Well, let's see. A couple of quick ones that I saw, one I liked, one I didn't. The Dictator is another one of these Sacha Baron Cohen movies where he finally does a character other than one he'd done on his old show, his old Ali G show. I mean, there was a horrible Ali G movie. There was a hilarious Borat movie, and there was a pretty good Bruno the fashion designer movie. And then now he's come out with a new character that could fit right in with that crowd called The Dictator. I forget what his actual name is. It doesn't matter. But it's a really raunchy, dirty movie. In fact, my wife and I were just talking about it briefly on the way home from my wife's mom's today. And my 13-year-old stepdaughter said, "Oh, have y'all seen that? I wanted to see it." And we both looked at her and said, "No, you are not seeing The Dictator anytime soon," because it's got a lot of, you know, it's pretty raunchy, pretty filthy, but it has some really funny stuff. I mean, I'll give you one little snippet is when the dictator guy and his henchmen are on a helicopter, and there's like a nice American elderly couple with them, and they're flying around on a tour of New York City, and the two of them are talking in Arabic, and the subtitles are saying, you know, like, "Oh, I haven't been here since September 11. You know, "Oh, the last time I was here, I went up in those skyscrapers and got to eat at this nice dinner, you know, there." And they're just saying all this innocuous stuff. But the couple across from them is hearing September 11, skyscrapers, you know, all this stuff. And they just start panicking. And it's a pretty funny bit where they are misunderstanding, you know, and then it starts getting absurd. But I thought the dictator.
No, go ahead.
No, it's a pretty funny movie. It's pretty cute. He's such a great comic actor. And he has this little running bit through it where whenever he wants to order somebody executed, he does kind of the cut in the throat gesture. And so, you know, he'll be talking nice to somebody and he'll look to the camera and kind of do the little throat cutting gesture. And it's pretty cute too. So there's some fun stuff in that movie.
I think Bruno kind of turned me off of Sacha Baron Cohen for a while. So,
well, you guys need to rent it or something because you'd have a fun time. It's got some pretty good comedy in it. Battleship. Now, I got that one on video, and I made it about halfway through. And I'm mentioning it now at all just to warn you, those of you listening that haven't seen it yet, don't. Because, see, here's the thing. When the trailers of it first started playing last year, everybody was groaning and going, "Oh, this looks horrible. Oh, my God. Oh, it's a battleship movie. Oh, how stupid." And I was sitting there going, "This trailer looks pretty cool." I'm sitting there thinking, if you didn't put battleship on it, if you just said alien robots versus the U.S. Navy, I'd be all over that. And I thought putting the game name on it kind of turned a lot of people off. So I watched it with the intention of looking to like it and to go, "Ha, you people all sold it short. You prejudged it prematurely." And I got about halfway through it and I'm like, "This is awful. Those people knew exactly what they were talking about. The acting is bad. The characters are stupid." It only dawned on me later just how dumb it was when I realized that the aliens shoot missiles at the battleships that are cylinders and stick into the deck and then explode.
Like the pegs.
Yes. Yes. Oh, my goodness.
I almost went to see that at the theater based on the strength of the director alone.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I didn't.
No, I couldn't even finish it. I didn't care. I was rooting for the alien robots eventually. I just wanted these stupid, stupid people to die.
I wish I had made that same decision on the next alien movie.
Oh, well, here we go then. Because next up is Prometheus. Now, let me just say up front, Mark Buskett and I did an extended review of it on episode 1. So I've already made my position on this movie clear, which in a nutshell is gorgeous movie to look at, wonderful music, wonderful cinematography. Everything that doesn't involve thinking is great. Then as soon as you start trying to make sense out of it, the whole thing falls apart. So what do you think?
I think it was starkly beautiful to see. I think exactly what you said. It's gorgeous to watch. I think it has some of the dumbest characters and dumbest ideas I've ever seen in
ever,
a movie in my
ever,
life.
Yes.
It has this pretentious nature of trying to be high-minded, mm-hmm. and then this ship that supposedly, you know, flew out for a number of years at the cost of trillions of dollars brings along a biologist who thinks that biology is reaching out to pet the thing that looks like a cobra that's making a threat display at you. Are you kidding me?
And that's after
that you've got a mapping guy who gets lost while he has his gear that has mapped the area. Everything that happens in this movie happens simply to push the plot forward because there's nothing else that will do it.
Damon Lindelof.
Oh, that guy, I don't know why anybody hires that guy to do anything.
I know. It's insane.
And the whole movie is terrible. You know, somebody gives themselves a C-section in the middle of the movie, and then after a while, they're running around like nothing happened, and nobody asks them a question. You know, I mean, it's so easy to nitpick this movie to death because it just sits in your face and goes, "Look how stupid this is."
But I tell you, as soon as I saw it, and I agree with everything that you say, and I've said all that myself on here. As soon as I saw it, I said, I've got to get a Blu-ray player now because I don't want to see this movie on DVD. I've got to see this movie in as clear, as crisp of a picture as I possibly can. And I've probably watched it 3 times on Blu-ray since I got it, just because it's so much fun to watch.
You're killing brain cells.
I know, but it's just such a wonderful, it just makes you weep for what it could have been. It could have been awesome. It could have been a great movie.
It tried to be this high-minded science fiction movie and a teen slasher at the same time.
The brilliant scientists in it act more stupid and more illogically than any teenager in a like Friday the 13th movie.
I mean, think about it. They go, "Hey, here's 6 dots on a wall, and we found 6 dots on a wall in a bunch of other places. Let's go to a star." What? I mean, it just jumps from here's 6 dots on a wall, then you're in space.
Yeah, it does.
I don't know. It just it very bad. Well, very bad, 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 Mr. Scott.
Yeah, but again, for those listening, if you appreciate the art of filming, it is worth watching. I think at least once, just to appreciate the beauty of it. And then I love the score. The music is just fantastic. So anyway, it's just such a disappointment of what it could have been. So
yeah, no, it is.
Moving on. Brave. I'm required to see movies of this sort because I have a 4-year-old. And let me just tell you, we have enough little redheaded dolls around our house now to sink the battleship itself. We've got, every Brave toy there is. So she loved it. I thought for a Pixar movie, there wasn't a lot to it to me. I want to enjoy Pixar movies, but I just felt like, let me put it this way. The problem I had with Brave, because it's a gorgeous, again, it's a gorgeous movie to look at. Just the scene where she rides her horse and shoots her bow, her bow at these different targets. And you realize her hair is bouncing, and you can see every individual hair bouncing. I'm just watching that going, oh my gosh, this is what we can do with technology now. But at the same time, with the story, is basically that she accidentally turns her mother into a bear and has to change her back. And I kept thinking, okay, well, this is like one part of the story, and there's going to be some bigger story, or there's something more to it or something. That's the whole movie.
Well, This is a Disney movie released by Pixar.
Yeah.
That's
a good way of
which is how I took it. It's a Disney princess.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I liked it a lot. I thought it was funny, and I thought it was exciting in places. I like the mother-daughter scenes, both, you know, when they're human, and both one's human and one's a bear. But it does lack something that you kind of expect out of Pixar movies, and I can't quite touch what that was.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't reach.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got a great mother-daughter storyline, and there probably needs to be more movies that are mother-daughter storylines.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it was just missing some thing that Up had, for instance. I mean, Up had you bawling in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah. You know, I think you're right. I think that it with Pixar movies, you expect at this point that they're going to go to 11 every so often in the movie. You're going to be like, whoa. And with this movie, you always kind of were at around 8. It never, I mean, it was always like, wow, this is neat, but it was never like, whoa. There were, I can't remember a single moment in that movie that I was like, wow, other than just look how they can animate hair now.
And that's what's funny. I've been sitting here looking at the list of movies that we've seen, and that's the movie where I keep thinking about it, and I go, it's the one that's the most vague in my head.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember what happened, but I don't remember scenes very well.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's not many that stand out.
And a lot of those were the ones that were in the trailer that you saw over and over and over.
Right.
Like, you know, like her archery contest.
The archery contest.
Yeah, and the little boys. The little boys are funny, but everything that they do that's funny in the movie is in the trailer. That's the thing. I mean, all the cool stuff in the movie is in the trailer, and the rest of the movie you didn't see in the trailer is just her and her mother dealing with her mother being a bear. And that's sweet, and that's nice, but I was just wanting more cool stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's yeah, and I agree with you. It's funny. Disney's is rolling out like this whole new line, apparently, of these updated Disney princesses where the new ones are much more cartoon characters with big, giant eyes. Tangled was the first one, I guess, unless I'm forgetting one. And now Brave, you know. And they're much more cartoonish. They don't look like Ariel. They don't look like Belle. They don't even look like the girl in the Frog, the Princess and the Frog. That was kind of the last of the old school ones. And now they're doing these CGI Disney princesses that are cartoonish. And it's funny because when I look at Mira's toys, or like if there's a package, you'll see Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, you know, all of them. And then you'll have like the Tangled girl, and she looks like an alien stuck in there with those, you know, because they don't match.
Right.
So it's kind of a weird transitional time, I think, that we're in for Disney and their whole little.
Well, I'm hoping this is not a sign of things to come, because the last three Pixar movies, I think it's the last three, have not really been. I just haven't liked them as much as I've liked the previous ones. And I feel like Disney and Pixar are kind of merging and crossing, and it's not for the best.
Yeah.
In what they do.
Yep.
So I
would agree. Yeah. So, I mean, definitely worth seeing, especially if you got kids, but it's not quite what they used to be from Pixar. I agree. I wonder if Steve Jobs being not among us anymore has anything to do with that. I don't know. He'd go in there and kick their butts and said, make this better. And they would have. Let's see. The Amazing Spider-Man. Now, you have not seen this one yet.
No.
Are you planning on it, or what do you think?
Yeah, it'll probably happen someday.
What is your sort of thinking that makes you feel that way? I'm curious.
I never liked the Peter Parker's parents were spies storyline.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the implication that I got out of the trailers that Peter was designed to be Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the implication that I got out of the trailers that Kurt Connors was not a decent man.
Mm.
Other than that, it's just too soon.
Yeah.
Spider-Man 3 was such a debacle that I'm just not ready to see Spider-Man on the screen.
That's kind of how I felt. I was excited for the first one. I was excited for the second one. I was, you know, fairly excited for the third one. But I just could not get up any, especially in the same summer as the Avengers. I just could not, and that Batman movie, which we're about to get to next, I just could not muster up any enthusiasm for a retelling of Spider-Man's origin. And even with the lizard, I mean, the one thing about it that I was looking forward to was at least we get the lizard finally. But of course, the lizard that had been built up in the first three movies is thrown out. They just wasted all that time that you had the one-armed, you know, Kurt Connors in the first three movies, because this starts everything over again with a different actor in a different situation. And so I just felt like – and when you reboot the lizard to just his starting out from the beginning again, he's just like – he's just a big, strong guy, really. He's just a monstrous, strong guy. He's not – he doesn't have much interesting going on to me. And the whole – you know, the whole genetic storyline and just everything that's in it I've seen before. And, I mean, they didn't do a bad job of retelling it, but it wasn't a horrible movie. I just was kind of like, why? Why not just make a new Spider-Man movie with a new story?
Well, the reason why is because Sony – has a lease on Spider-Man, and they have to keep making movies every, what, 3 years or they lose it.
Yeah, something like that.
So get ready for a deluge of Spider-Man movies, no matter what the quality.
Well, I'll put it this way. I'm much more looking forward to the next one of these than I was to this one, because now we've done the origin, and we've finally gotten the lizard out of the way. So maybe now they'll pick somebody that, you know, Spider-Man's got one of the best rogues galleries in comics. I don't want to see another Green Goblin. I don't want to see another Doc Ock.
Well, it's building up to Green Goblin. I mean, Oscorp's in the movie.
No, I know, but well, maybe they can do the. I'll put it this way: they've done the Green Goblin basically twice now. One with Harry, and one with Norman, and both were terrible. I thought so. Maybe we can get a good Green Goblin.
You know something that a friend of mine at work and I were talking about this. We were talking about Spider-Man 3. And we were talking about Bruce Campbell being in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it came around to the idea that what they should – and this has nothing to do with what they do in the next movie. But in Spider-Man movies,
mm-hmm.
they need to start with a Bond-like initial sequence where Spider-Man is fighting a minor villain in an exciting way at the beginning.
Oh.
That way you could throw characters like Mysterio in, who probably couldn't carry a whole movie. You have him finish off Mysterio, and then the main gist of the movie starts.
That would be awesome. That's a very good idea.
And that would be really cool, because you'd wonder, what villain are they going to have in the opening this time? Because, you know, people would go to see Bond movies for a while just to see what the opening sequence was going to
be. Sure, because they're awesome. Yeah, see, now I'm imagining Spider-Man walking across the stage, and instead of the gun barrel, you got the web in a circle.
Right, something
da-da,
like that.
Boom, da-da.
But I think that would be a great thing yes. that they could do with just about any superhero
yes.
film, because it would get these characters that people really kind of want to see into the movie. It would amp up the adrenaline, if it's done right, mm-hmm. you know, for the audience to get excited to get into the movie. I don't know why they haven't done that.
No,
it seems like a perfect natural fit for superhero stuff.
You're exactly right. I never would have thought of that, but that's fantastic. I wish they would do that. Yeah, because the main reason you can't use all these superheroes is it has to make sense for the main story. But if you do it as like a throwaway bit, like a beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark or beginning of James Bond, then it doesn't have to necessarily, you know, it can just be. It can be a very ancillary part of the story. That's a good idea. Well, speaking of superheroes, the other big superhero movie of the year, of course, was The Dark Knight Rises. And I've said this a million times, but I'm going to say it for the audience here, that there must have been a Viagra truck that spilled into the water supply of superhero movies, because Rise of the Silver Surfer, Dark Knight Rises, there's been like a dozen movies in the last few years that something was rising. And there sure is a whole lot of rising going on. I can only imagine that they did a poll and test audiences thought that movies with the word rises in it were more interesting than other, you know, other verbs. So everybody's suddenly rising, you know, congratulations, guys, you've beaten, you know, your condition and you're rising. So it's just weird. But well, what were your thoughts on The Dark Knight Rises?
Wow, really?
Oh, you think the darkness is your ally?
I thought it was one of it was overhyped. It was not a good movie. It was not well edited. It wasn't well written. It was pretty bland and boring. I mean, the villain disappears in a blink of an eye in a scene, and you're like, really? Is that the end of him?
I know.
Really? That was it? It broadcasts what's going to happen from a mile away. The only scene in the movie that I liked was one involving Anne Hathaway as Catwoman, who in my opinion was the best character in the movie. Where, you know, she's in a scene and she's calm, cool, and collected, and then suddenly she's on the floor screaming her head off. The change, the duplicitous nature of the character in that situation was fantastic. I loved that scene.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the movie, it's just, I don't know. It's like they go into the stock exchange to steal stuff at lunch,
mm-hmm.
and they say quite clearly that they've got 16 minutes to finish this, and then they get on motorcycles and jump over the partition ramps, which have curiously been the dividers that have come up to keep people from leaving, that have curiously been left in ramp position. Okay, they run off on that, and then in almost immediately it's nighttime.
Yeah, that was weird.
How did it become nighttime? And then all the cops start chasing Batman instead of chasing the guys who just raided and terrorized the stock exchange. It's just,
and then they send,
I don't know.
And then they send every policeman in Gotham into the sewer. I mean, all of them.
And then when they come out, they do those great police tactics of walking straight forward into a hail of gunfire.
The frontal assault is what they're teaching at police academy these days.
It devolves into a punching match. And is there anybody who's worse in big budget movies at shooting action scenes than Christopher Nolan?
Right. Oh man.
They're boring.
Yeah.
I can't grasp the appeal of this movie, and it must be a problem with me.
No, I agree.
Or it's the hype of Batman that I just don't share in.
I think there's a lot of carryover from the last one. But see, I was one of the only people that wrote a really negative review of the middle one. I mean, yeah, I love the Joker. I watched 30 minutes of him, just his antics. That was fun. But see, one of my several complaints about the second one was that Batman was about the sixth most important character in it. At least Batman is in this one a little bit more. But he's still, it's like Nolan's got so many characters he wants to play with, and he just, I don't feel like he ever can focus enough on any of them to, in fact, I thought Alfred was a more important character in this movie almost than Batman.
The scenes where Michael Caine appears on film are so embarrassing. He is putting out so much angst and emotion that nobody else in this film shares.
Yeah.
The scene at the end where he's crying, I just felt so uncomfortable watching that because I didn't care. It didn't seem like anybody else in the movie cared, but he is in tears.
Yeah.
And it's just a terribly uncomfortable scene to watch. And I don't know. I think one of my problems with this is you hear all these people talk about how this is superheroes done right in a realistic fashion. And, you know, to me, Dark Knight was just James Bond wearing a cape.
Yeah.
The big action scene is I get picked up by a plane. Well, that happened in a James Bond movie in the 60s, too.
Well, yeah, the superpower Batman has in the second movie is to have a lot of money.
But yeah, pretty much. And this movie, you know, my problem is they talk about how this is realistic and dark, and yet then they don't have a problem with the fact that you can cure a broken back by beating somebody on the back a couple of times, hanging them upside down, and then doing push-ups. It's like, I mean, I'm perfectly willing to forgive characters that get shot in the arm, like in Raiders of the Lost Ark and all that kind of stuff, if the tone of the movie fits that.
Yeah.
This movie tries to have its cake and eat it too, and it just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I
and the villain was so boring.
Yeah.
I mean, you take a great actor like Tom Hardy and hide him behind a mask with a voice that it was still difficult to understand.
I know.
Especially when Mr. Hans Zimmer is boom, 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 boom in the background all constantly.
Yeah, that,
you know,
that one line that I always quote, because it's the only thing I could understand that he said in the whole movie, is when Batman, like when it gets dark and you hear him go, "Oh, you think darkness is your ally?" I just started laughing in the theater. I'm thinking I'm probably not supposed to be laughing at this point, but I'm sitting there going, "That was funny." So yeah, we're probably going to get shellacked for ragging on The Dark Knight Rises so much, but
especially since we also liked Avengers. Apparently, you can't like both of those movies. I don't understand that either.
Yeah,
but. Whatever.
I understand the idea that it's dark and serious and everything, and I like that up to a point, but it's all the other stuff.
See, the thing is, I don't even particularly think it was very dark.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to talk about a movie in a minute that was made for, you know, a fifth the money of Batman and was much darker and much more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So...
let me see what else. Some of this I want to mention this just because it's one of my favorite movies. Lawrence of Arabia came out 50 years ago, and I show this movie every semester to my Middle East history class. It takes us about 2 weeks to get all the way through it, and it's a very long movie, but it's such a glorious, glorious film. Everything about it is just wonderful. It was released theatrically in a few select places this summer, and I wish I could have seen it on the big screen, even though I do watch it at least twice a year, like I said, sometimes three, depending on how many sections of that course I teach. And that movie is fantastic. Have you ever seen it?
I have not seen it.
Oh, you need to see it. It's got...
beyond the little snippet of it that's in Prometheus.
Yeah, it was kind of funny that that's happened to come out this year because that they used that piece from it in there. But Omar Sharif as Sharif Ali, and the other Arab characters in it are fantastic. You have the British actors in it, and their names are escaping me at the moment, but it has just such a great cast. It has Louis from Casablanca as an older man now, playing sort of the British diplomat who's working in league with the British military to kind of steal the Middle East away from the Arabs, you know, at the end of the war. And you have a very naive Lawrence. He has about five different ranks in the movie. He's Major Lawrence, he's Colonel Lawrence, whatever, but kind of caught in the middle. And it's just a really great story. And you watch that movie and think, how did Peter O'Toole not win Best Actor for this? And you know, if he didn't win it for that, they were going to have to give it to him as kind of a makeup later on. And I don't think they ever have. I don't think he's ever won it. And really, this was the one that he should have gotten it for. So it's really too bad. But that's a great movie if you haven't ever seen it. And that's part one of our look at the best and worst of movies of 2012. We thank you for joining us this week. And I hope you'll come back in a few days for part two, where we get all the way through December and wrap things up with a sort of an unexpected journey. So in the meantime, we hope that you'll visit White Rocket Books, www.whiterocketbooks.com. You can follow me, Van Allen Plexico, at Van Allen Plexico on Twitter, or on Facebook, Van Allen Plexico. Otherwise, we will see you all down the road. Thanks for listening.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.